So it's time to thank you very much, Claude. Thank you for your questions. And we will move to the last talk of the day. David Hunter will speak about phylogenies, risk scores, pronostic, predictive, practical way of doing it, I guess. And you have 30 minutes.
Well, thank you very much, and I'd like to thank Arno and Hugh for the opportunity to speak here today. It's been a real privilege to hear all the speakers this afternoon. I guess I'm not so grateful for being asked to speak last, particularly after that very deep philosophical talk. And what I'll try and do is bring together a few of the themes from the day into this topic of polygenic risk scores, which a few of the other speakers have flagged, but been good enough not to explain in great detail. In the words of Dr. Kushner, I think these are a major irreversible fact that we have found suddenly to be upon us and that we're going to have to learn to deal with in our interactions with both patients and populations. And I'll talk a little bit about polygenic risk scores as prognostic, meaning what information do they give us about the future probabilities of a particular illness or even a characteristic. Predictive in this sense means, well, is that useful? Does it predict something that I can do in my life or the health system can do for me to maybe reduce my risk? And then the practicalities, again, already referred to, are deep and wide, and so I will discuss some of those. So this is really big data, but it's big in the sense that we didn't have these data 15 or 20 years ago. Sometimes we did have big data, lots of people, but we'd have a very little information about each person. Or we'd have deep studies, like the Framingham Heart Study going for 50 years. We'd have a lot of information about people, but not so many people. But now, of course, we have the opportunity to have really big data, huge amounts of data on huge numbers of people. And this really has been most confronting with respect to the subject of most of today's discussion, genetic epidemiology and risk factors for disease. I'm going to be talking initially mainly about breast cancer, because that's mainly what I've been involved in, but it sort of serves as a paradigm for the other major diseases, other major cancers, heart disease, cancer, etc. But it's not that long. Barely more than 10 years ago, since we were just thrilled to be able to interrogate genomes in about 1,100 cases and controls and squeak out one genome-wide significant variant that we didn't previously appreciate was associated with risk of breast cancer. But then, as more data came along, we found some more. And Jonathan Marchini and Ray Walters both referred to this website, which I didn't know about, even though I'm from Oxford, Oxford Big, where you can go and you can plug in your disease or phenotype of interest, and you'll get the UK Biobank Manhattan plot, which in this case has about 7 or 8 variants. The biggest one there still is the FGFR2 initial finding, which still persists as the strongest. But based on, I'm not absolutely sure, but I think about 3,000 of the 300,000 women who said, I've been diagnosed with breast cancer in my past, so this was just the prevalent information at baseline enrollment in UK Biobank, I could do in 30 seconds of Googling what took hundreds of people and many millions of dollars to discover in the first place. In the other studies, here are about 7 or 8 genetic variants that are associated with breast cancer. It also illustrates one of the other things about UK Biobank that we didn't talk about. So UK Biobank is absolutely a fabulous resource, 500,000 people, but open access, etc. When you come to individual diseases, you need to look at that in conjunction with the information from the large disease-specific consortia. So for breast cancer, Doug Easton at University of Cambridge coordinates a big consortium that's up to about 110,000 cases of breast cancer. So if you're interested in doing discovery of new things for most diseases, then you need to incorporate a lot of other data, and then you can take it to the UK Biobank and ask, well, do I see the same things? You can get a lot of information about calibration with respect to whether your information really does predict absolute risk in a longitudinal population-based study. But for the less common diseases, the rare diseases, we're still not in a position where we have anything like enough data. For the rarer diseases, people struggle to put together a few thousand cases, which would be predicted to give you about 7 or 8 genetic hits, but not all of the, in the case of breast cancer, 180 hits, and we heard earlier for the other diseases, many of them more than 100 hits, because we've been able to assemble over 100,000 cases or many tens of thousands of cases. A little bit different for the quantitative traits like height and weight and blood pressure, where 500,000 people in UK Biobank have that information, and so you've got a lot more statistical power for that. So we're largely talking about the genetics of relatively common diseases. We've still got many, many years, even decades of work before we've been able to put together enough information for some of the less common diseases. So even at the point where we just had 7 or 8 variants, in this case 10, we were able to put them together into a risk score. How many adverse variants does a woman carry for the 10 variants we knew first about for breast cancer? And those of you who are familiar with area under the curve, receiver-operated curves, will know that none of these particular curves are very dramatically predictive of case control status. For that to be the case, we'd need something that looked much more like this. But with just the 10 variants, we were able to take the previous model that was based on classical epidemiologic risk factors for breast cancer that had been the subject of the 50 years of breast cancer epidemiology prior, and we were able to outperform that based just only on the genetic information alone. But of course, adding the genetic and non-genetic information gave you the best predictive score. And that remains the case for pretty much everything. And we do tend to see a lot of presentations of, here's my polygenic risk score, but it's worth bearing in mind that it's almost always worth asking a question, well, are there simple things people can tell me, such as family history, that I should incorporate into my prognostic risk? And almost always there'll be some extra information that you can obtain from clinical records or from people themselves at low cost, which will add to the simple polygenic risk score. And what are the polygenic risk scores? Well, it just means that I take all of my individual variants, in this case up to 77 variants, and I run a regression equation and I calculate for each person whether their risk is high, medium, or normal, sort of roughly on a, for most common diseases, a normal distribution with a bit of a long tail to the right. And so I generate a score based on the number of risky variants someone carries versus the number of, quote, protective variants someone carries. Now, in the early days, Pete Kraft, who you worked with, and I looked at this, and in the very early days, which was when we only had 10 or such of these, you had to be very careful. So this diagram just basically shows for people at low, medium, and high risk, calculated from a limited number of genetic variants, what would happen if we, this was back 10 years ago, imagined we had another 200 yet to be discovered alleles that were randomly distributed, but we could factor into the risk prediction. And so it just meant, this is sort of average risk, genetic relative risk of one. Some people who we might say were high risk actually ultimately might be at low risk, vice versa. Some people we think are at low risk ultimately might just inherit a bad hand of these yet to be discovered variants and be at high risk. So if you're only dealing with a handful of variants, by and large, you have to recognize that there's a lot more to be discovered, and that what you tell somebody today might need to be modified next year and the year after. That's when you're dealing with a small number. The good news is, for the common diseases, breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, inflammatory bowel disease at some level, there's enough information that these are now much, much more stable. And even though somebody might move up and down in their percentile of risk, it's unlikely now that you'd tell someone that they're at high risk and, in fact, they're at reduced risk. But we do need to really acknowledge that with respect to the less common diseases. Not all polygenic risk scores are at this point equally robust and predictive. And that's going to remain the case for many of the rare diseases. So if you tell me I'm at the 95th percent of risk of prostate cancer, you know, I'm probably at the 95% of risk plus or minus a small amount. If you tell me, based on the information you have, I'm at 95% of risk of something rare like soft tissue sarcoma, I'm probably, you know, 95 plus or minus, well, not plus that much, but minus quite a lot, because we're in the very early days of this research. And when you look under the hood of some of the commercially available genetic tests, it is kind of scary that they're still using information that's not completely up to date and comprehensive, and so they're guaranteed to be giving you information that may not be as predictive as it could be if they were just simply incorporating in their algorithms all of the information we know about. But we've had this deluge of information. These are from the NHGRI EMBL catalog. All of the variants associated with all of the diseases. For breast cancer, it's about 180 genome-wide significant SNPs based on studies of more than 110,000 cases. And again, for the common things, things are relatively stable, and so you can produce nomograms like this. So if a woman, this is breast cancer, if a woman is at the 99th percentile of risk or above it, her lifetime risk up to about age 80 would be predicted to be over 30%. And that's actually at the sort of lower end of what you'd predict for BRCA1, BRCA2, and somebody who doesn't have a strong family history of breast cancer. So you can make an argument that at the extremes of these risks, we're already somewhere in the terrain of the single gene disorders with high penetrance and high lifetime risks. Of course, at the other end, very low risk, and here's the 95th percentile, here's the average risk. So if you look at the top 5% compared with the average, that's a relative risk of about threefold. Bottom 5% versus the bottom, it's approaching threefold. Top to bottom, sixfold. So we're starting to generate non-trivial differences in risk that may have some clinical utility. The other way you can look at this is if you've got a disease on which you intervene currently based on age, then you may have a way of predicting risk of age at onset. So in the UK, most women don't have mammography until the National Mammography Service steps in and says, at 50, we want you to have your first mammogram and have one every 3 years. But if you took, and that's based on essentially probability of developing breast cancer in the next X years, but if you took an average, the orange line, 50-year-old, if she was in the top 5% of risk, she would hit that level of risk about 7 or 8 years earlier, and at the extreme, almost 10 years earlier. So if we did imagine a world where everyone had a risk score available, you could imagine that the rational thing to do would be to stratify your mammography service so high-risk women get seen earlier and maybe often. At the low risk, if you're in the bottom percentile, you actually never quite cross the risk of an average 50-year-old woman. So, you know, subject for ethical debate, would you ever recommend to a woman, well, you're at such low risk, you never need, or it's not rational for our system, it's not good a use of our resources to be giving you mammograms. So all of these issues are up for grabs. But again, the mind-boggling thing to somebody like me who's seen this emerge at sort of warp speed is how robust this information is. So now you take the polygenic risk score and you look at the risk and the confidence interval associated with a one standard deviation increase in risk from the median, and you run it past your, I think it's 10 studies that are set up as prospective nested case control studies, and essentially you get the same risk estimate from all of them. So really rock solid, robust risk prediction. Then UK Biobank becomes available, and again, right on the average. So once you've got this vast amount of data, you can condense it down to information that then is highly reproducible. It's not like a lot of the information that we deal with where we're constantly doing small studies and not seeing what the other people did who are doing small studies have seen. You can also think of this as a continuous distribution of risk. And here in blue, this is the information from the Breast Cancer Association Consortium for the polygenic risk score. What proportion of women are at this lifetime risk of breast cancer? And then you can take your questionnaire-based risk factors, including family history, in this case, to keep it simple, including mammographic density, which is a breast cancer risk factor that some systems that do mammography now tell women about, but many still don't. But you put together your best non-genetic score and you combine it with your polygenic risk score. And so some women who were said to be at low risk are at even lower risk when you factor in maybe the absence of family history, their late age at menarche, their early age at first birth, their multiple parity, all of the things that would be protective against breast cancer. Similarly, some of the women who are at high risk are at even higher risk, possibly because they have a couple of relatives with breast cancer, they had early menarche, late age at first birth, one child, late menopause, etc. So this is always going to be the best estimator of risk and makes the case that we need to continue, as Dr. Baruchi urged us, to connect information about personal and environmental lifestyle risk and get it in the databases, because we can't just assume that this genetic thing isn't modified by other information that is in lifestyle and environmental exposures. So how is that? So again, I don't want to overemphasize the prevention prediction. So here's a bunch of the questionnaire-only, density-only, SNP, and all factors combined risk curves, very similar to what we saw. But Monsi Garcia-Closas and others asked the question, well, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force says if a woman is above a 3% five-year absolute of risk of breast cancer, then there should be a discussion about taking tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor as a prophylactic anti-hormonal reducer of breast cancer risk. So if you run all of this information together, then 18% of women at age 60 account for 40% of the future cases of breast cancer. So you might focus on them, but you still have to acknowledge in the counseling, et cetera, that still 60% of the cases are occurring in women who are not in that highest strategy. And then all sorts of other wrinkles, subgroups. So breast cancer, about 80% of breast cancers, postmenopausally, ER positive, maybe that's 70% for premenopausal, most of the rest ER negative. And so most of the information we have in total breast cancer risk is for ER positive breast cancer. So all of these risk predictors work really well for all breast cancers or ER positive, not so well for ER negative. So that's the sort of other way we can think of less common diseases. As we subtype our common diseases, then we have to acknowledge that we're not predicting for many of those subtypes. And finally, all of this information in red here has been pretty much generated on people of European ancestry. Someone asked the question about French people. Well, French people are probably sufficiently European that even though you might not have much local data, you can infer from the other European ancestry countries. And some of the scores actually work pretty well for Hispanic people and some of the South Asian and East Asian populations, but much less well for people of African ancestry. So as a matter of equity, if you're going to offer this to people, and you look around the streets of Paris, you know, a lot of people of African ancestry aren't going to benefit from this information at this stage in our research to the same extent. So I won't repeat all of this. Said most of it, may interact with screening. Key thing is that you want to do this for one polygenic risk score, well, that's about $30 or $40. And you'll have all of the other information available to you as long as you do the sort of comprehensive CHIP. And most tests we order already cost more than $30 or $40. And then once it's in the electronic medical record, it can be there forever. But it's certainly available to be mined both for research, but also by people and their health professionals for risk of now literally dozens of diseases. Finally, some of this information may be of relevance to those of you who treat people or consult with people who may have a rare disease. So somebody has some vague symptoms in their joints, but if they're at the 90th percentile of risk for rheumatoid arthritis, maybe you would do a little more workup. If they have a DVT and they're at 90th percentile for a thrombophilia, well, maybe they should stay on anticoagulation for a bit longer, or even perhaps lifetime. Does any of this interact with things that we have the power to deal with in our daily lives? The quick answer is if you look at this on the relative risk scale, you did a lot of this work in Boston, by and large, if you're low, medium, or high genetic risk, then those relative risks associated with some known risk factor are going to be the same. But of course, that predicts that people who are at high risk, who are maybe at twice the risk, there's going to be a lot more cases occur because the baseline risk in the high risk category is much higher. So the absolute risk or the risk difference will be very different. In breast cancer, take the genome-wide associated SNPs as they become available, 39 SNPs, 17 SNPs. Take all of your classic breast cancer risk factors. See if you can describe a model where you get a supra-multiplicative interaction or an infra-multiplicative interaction. And the quick answer is nothing survives multiple comparisons. So the risks of the environmental and lifestyle just multiply with your genetic risk. And so what that means, of course, is though that if you are have these modifiable breast cancer risk factors, heavy drinker, smoker, obese, taking hormone replacement therapy, and you compare that with someone who doesn't have any of those risk factors, the relative risk here is about 2 on this absolute scale. The relative risk here is about 2. Here are deciles of genetic risk from low risk to high risk. But there's a lot more cases of breast cancer occurring in this stratum than in this stratum. And it's arguable, too, that if you had, let's say, anti-estrogen, an intervention with definite side effects, that the risk-benefit would be greater if a woman's at high risk than at low risk, because she's more likely to receive the benefit than if she's at low risk, where she may be equally likely to experience the adverse effects. So think of things on a multiplicative and a risk difference scale. I'll just say same thing for heart disease: low, intermediate, high, favorable lifestyle, low risk, unfavorable lifestyle, high risk. And the relative risk is about 2, top to the bottom, but a lot more cases occurring, bigger risk difference in this high stratum. This is actually putting people on a treadmill, and now high fitness is protective against heart disease, but it's equally protective on the relative risk scale, whether you're low, intermediate, or high genetic risk. But more cases would be prevented if you were able to convert people from low cardiorespiratory fitness to high in this higher risk stratum. And then statins, let me just skip through that. Dr. Dubé sort of referred to this. Statins work in people at low risk and high risk. There's a bit of evidence that the relative risk might be a little stronger if you're at higher genetic risk. But the key thing is this is a high genetic risk, low all others. And this is, if you're on the placebo in the west of Scotland, statin trial. If you're on statin, about half your risk here, only about a 25% reduction here, but much, much bigger reduction in risk difference. So many, many more cases prevented than in an equivalently sized stratum of low risk. And but, you know, statins still are protective in people at low risk. So with some exceptions, and the exceptions are things like bad reactions to drugs, where, you know, 0.1% of people will have a really bad reaction to a drug because they have a single locus that causes them not to metabolize that drug or otherwise predicts a high risk. Mostly for the general lifestyle environment and the general category of genetic risk, we're talking about multiplicative interactions, which is actually good because it makes the risk prediction algorithms much more predictable. If we had to count for a lot of odd synergies or canceling out of associations, we'd have a much harder time communicating risk to people, or an even harder time. We can still think for some intervention that's uniquely expensive that you might want to focus that on the people highest in genetic risk. And all of this we wouldn't have predicted 20 years ago when we thought we were going to find lots and lots of uniquely susceptible people and uniquely resistant people. And we thought we were going to find lots of gene-environment interactions. In general, they've been fairly hard to find. Let me just finish with some practical matters. So costs have plummeted. You know, usually you see the graph of sequencing cost sort of going to zero, but it still costs, even at scale, $300 or $400 to get your whole genome sequence. Costs you another $1,000 or $2,000 for somebody to actually interpret any of it. But the actual raw cost of the sequencing is low. But as we heard from some of the other speakers, we can get 90% of the juice by doing a much smaller set of variants, because most of the variants in the genome aren't doing anything. And so genotyping costs have come down at about the same. And so when I started this, I don't think we paid quite $15 per genotype, but it was a good day's work for somebody to generate 24 SNPs, one SNP on 24 people. And now we're in a world where you can generate 800,000 SNPs on hundreds of people and impute 9 million or more SNPs out of the 800,000 SNPs. So the cost is down to, as I said before, $30 or $40 at scale. But all of the information communication issues are much, much more difficult. And this was a bit of a shock. everybody knew who was in the business that if you did 23andMe, they tested you for precisely three breast cancer variants in BRCA1 and BRCA2, the three that are more common in people of Ashkenazi Jewish origin. I was surprised twice to encounter well-educated women who told me that they'd done 23andMe and they were very relieved because they didn't carry a BRCA1, BRCA2 mutation. And so, you know, they either hadn't read the description or they hadn't understood. But that was 10 years ago, and lo and behold, this was worth saying in the New York Times that there's a huge difference between sequencing to find genetic variants and genotyping. Is it practical? It'll be cheap enough. I think you can make a case that you would add it to cardiovascular disease risk assessment. We heard a bit about that earlier. Other speakers, Adrian and others, have talked about the risk reaction in general. There's either sort of low, severe psychological impact, but again, as you go to millions of people instead of hundreds of people, what's your threshold for maybe doing some damage to a very, very small proportion of people? Potential risks might include, you know, I thought both of my parents were Irish, but you run my ancestry thing and you tell me I'm half Polish. What went on there? And all of the issues about who's going to regulate it. And of course, as Dr. Kirshner talked about it, are our clinical systems remotely ready for this? But it's here, so we better get ready quick. We're planning a big study in the UK of about a million people with the intent to ask them if they would like some information back. So that'll maybe give us information on scale. Here it is. It's got the grand name of Succeed. You can read the acronym. And I'd just like to acknowledge all the people who did the work, particularly in the breast cancer area, who've also been thinking very, very carefully about these translational, ethical, and other aspects. Thank you so much.